Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come before the court. We are here today in the case of Jennifer LaFave. This is a case of a DUI stop on or about February 19th, 2009. There was a probable cause hearing by the Superior Court in which probable cause was found for her arrest. At the outset of the argument, I would point out that this would be the first case ever in Delaware jurisprudence that probable cause was found when every field test that was properly administered was passed by the individual. If the court will recall, Ms. LaFave was initial stop was by an unmarked officer or an officer in an unmarked vehicle, witnessed two people in the vehicle.
Mr. Mooney.
Yes, sir.
Is the rule of law that you're arguing for that where the person who stopped passes all the field tests, then as a matter of law, there's no probable cause?
I don't think that that could be the rule of law, Your Honor. What the well-established law is that it's a balancing test, and the finder of fact or the judge is to balance all of the facts and circumstances relating to the particular incident.
So, theoretically, then it would be legally possible for someone who stopped to pass all of the tests and yet for there to be probable cause?
I think that's possible, Your Honor.
So why then wasn't there probable cause here in a sentence or two?
Yes, Your Honor. The positives in this case were Ms. LaFave's speech was determined to be understandable and not slurred. Her actions were normal. She got out of the vehicle normally. She performed perfectly the alphabet test, which is starting somewhere after the beginning to before the end, specifically in this case, E to P. She counted backwards perfectly. She was given the walk and turn test, which requires the person to do several things, including maintaining a heel-to-toe stance for a significant period of time, a one-leg stand test where the person is required to stand on one leg for a period of 30 seconds. All of those tests that were administered by the officer properly were passed by Mrs. LaFave.
Well, let me just ask you a question about chronology so I'm sure I understand your argument and the state's response.
Yes, sir.
In its summary of argument and its answering brief, the state characterizes your position as being, at the time the officer stopped her, if she had refused the test, probable cause to arrest her based on everything up until that point would have existed. However, the field tests were administered and she passed them all. Therefore, under the totality of the circumstances, she shouldn't have been arrested. Is that right so far?
That is, Your Honor.
So then my question is, if probable cause existed prior to the successful passing of the field test, your argument has to be that the successful field test performance negated the probable cause that had already been established under the totality of the circumstances.
Your Honor, first of all, it is not our position that probable cause existed at some point earlier in the contact.
All right, so then the state has mischaracterized your position when they put that in quotation marks.
That's correct, Your Honor. What we said in our argument was if those things were the only evidence, that could be consistent with B's, which is a prior ruling. that could be consistent with Bees. But by
which means probable cause.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But by definition, it can't be a totality of the circumstances analysis if evidence is ignored. In other words, some of the evidence that they are claiming existed was not in the initial observation. It was throughout the contact with Ms. Lefebvre.
All right. Well, just let me ask one more question so I'm clear in listening to your argument. Hypothetically speaking, if we had all of the facts in this case but no field test, the officer simply knows what he knows when he stops the car and arrests her for driving under the influence. Is that going to be probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, there were certain things that Officer Short observed that weren't communicated to Officer Page. So for the purposes of probable cause analysis, you can't impute knowledge from Short to Page if those things weren't communicated from Short to Page. But in this particular
case, by those things, do you mean how she drove when the unmarked police car stopped her?
Part of it, Your Honor. What Short communicated to Page is that she was tailgating somebody else, almost slammed into the back of them, turned into the restaurant without a signal, and that there was an odor of alcohol. That's all that was communicated from Short to Page. The other things
were... I thought there was reference to slurred speech.
Short testified that he, earlier in his contact when he saw them jumping around in the vehicle, that he noticed slurred speech. He never communicated that to Page. Now, Page did testify that he thought that Lefebvre's speech was slurred, but the trial judge specifically held that it was not. In this particular case, there was a videotape that had clear audio, and the judge in the lower court made the ruling that her speech was not slurred. Or at least understandable, and didn't say it was slurred.
So then we simply have the odor of alcohol and her admission that she had been drinking an hour and a half before the stop.
She said that she had a drink an hour and a half before the stop, Your Honor. The other factor that the lower court addressed was, and if you listen to the tape, or watch the tape, she makes the comment before the one-legged stand, and I'll quote it, that I'm not that good at this sober, was the statement that she made. That was mischaracterized multiple times during the hearing to say, I can't even do this if I was sober, or I couldn't do this if I was sober, even if I was sober. And that's not what she said. So that statement, in our estimation, is a red herring. It means nothing. Maybe she meant I could do this better if I wasn't sober. If I had a couple drinks, maybe I would be relaxed and be able to do the test better. So she never made an admission that she...
What would it take, under your view of the law, that is, what different facts would have to exist in this specific context for there to be probable cause to arrest?
Well, Your Honor, I think clearly some evidence of divided attention impairment, whether there be some trouble ambulating, whether there be some slurred speech.
You're talking about failing a field test? One or more?
I'm not going to make the argument, Your Honor, that if somebody passed the field tests, all the field tests, there's no way that a court would be legally precluded from finding probable cause. Certainly, I think there's some circumstances in which that could occur. The person could make admissions to drinking a lot of alcohol. There could be obviously impaired speech. There could be certain factors that a court could say the person passed all the field tests, But somehow, the in the totality of the circumstances, the other evidence outweighs the past field tests.
Well, here's our struggle, I think, at least mine, and that is the law appears clear that the analysis is based on, quote, the totality of the circumstances, close quote. The real question here is, what does that really mean when you put pen to paper and you start analyzing the subjective and the objective facts that are consistent with or inconsistent with somebody being under the influence? It's suggested in the state's brief and could, I suppose, be argued that so long as you have sufficient facts that support probable cause, you can completely discount those facts that don't support probable cause. But I can't square that away with the concept of totality of the circumstances. But that's basically the state's argument. If there's sufficient evidence apart from objective field tests that would constitute probable cause, then you have probable cause, and you simply don't get to the relative significance of the field test. Then on the other hand, anyone with practical experience in this area would suggest that the police officers don't even offer field tests unless they suspect they don't have adequate evidence of probable cause, and they fully expect the field test to nail down their case and show that the person is on an objective test basis, demonstrated that they're impaired. Here, that didn't happen. So what's the magic formula for weighing all that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court has rightly struggled with the concept of probable cause and in fact, has cited it many times and said it's an elusive concept.
Well, we're a three-judge panel, or three-justice panel. So we are bound by this concept of totality of the circumstances. But what I want you to do, please, is explain on these facts how a trial judge is supposed to apply the test of totality of the circumstances and how, in applying it, and this trial judge clearly thought that he was applying it, how did this trial judge get it wrong?
Okay, Your Honor. First of all, what we have is a difference between subjective observations and objective performance on field tests. The only thing that's out there that's indicative, and not even of impairment, but of consumption, is objective observations, bloodshot eyes. The officer said that there was an odor of alcohol, and
Did he say the odor of alcohol was coming from the car or coming from her personally?
I believe that the officer did testify eventually that it was coming from her personally.
Okay.
As I understand it, your argument is you could admit consuming alcohol and not be under the influence.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You can have the odor of alcohol on your breath and not be under the influence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Therefore, what we have is this officer smelling alcohol and her admission of consuming alcohol, and he's going to do the field test to pursue whether or not she's under the influence. And when he does the test, as the Chief Justice said, he normally expects confirmation of being under the influence. This case stands out in stark contrast to all the others because she passed all the tests. Argument is that if we look at balancing all of the circumstances, the objective positive performance on the test outweighs the fact that she admitted drinking and that she had alcohol in her breath.
Exactly, Your Honor. And to address the Chief Justice's question specifically, where I think the lower court got it wrong is he compared some of the observations in this case to Bees and said that it was close. But this case is completely different from Bees because there was one field test that was administered in Bees, which the person failed. The other field tests were kept out, the HGN and the PBT. But this case is completely different from Bees. She passed the rest of the field tests, five field tests. And what the way that the lower court got it wrong was it said specifically in the decision that there could be innocent explanations as to the passing of those field tests. The innocent explanations doctrine came from this court in the Maxwell decision. And in the Maxwell decision, there was a factual facts presented that said that there was an accident. The officers went to the scene. There was a dead child in the street. There was witnesses who said that Mr. Maxwell admitted that he was driving, that they were drinking. that there was an odor of alcohol in the vehicle. There was beer cans that were both empty and closed, strewn around the situation and around the accident. And what the court held in that case was the state didn't eliminate that the accident could have been caused by a mechanical failure. The state didn't eliminate the fact that the accident could have caused the alcohol containers to open once the accident occurred. The state didn't eliminate the fact that even if there was beer cans in the car, doesn't mean that Mr. Maxwell was drinking. And what this court said was that's improper. Just because there may be innocent explanations as to this incriminating evidence doesn't mean that that extinguishes the probable cause. And therefore, saying that it put an improper burden on the state to eliminate all innocent explanations as to this evidence. In this case, it's been applied to, well, there may be innocent explanations as to why she doesn't appear to be under the influence. And that's an improper application of the innocent explanation doctrine that was started in the Maxwell case. Also, briefly, with regard to the question of the officer already thinks that as suspicions, in this case there was a superior officer on the scene. He doesn't do any field tests but gives some of his opinions with regard to her. Page does the field tests, and this is just a matter of common sense. At the conclusion of the field tests, that's when the officer makes the decision as to whether to arrest or let the person go. This particular officer, Officer Page, as soon as the field test was completed, he says, okay, go back and get in your car. That's not going to happen if he thinks that he has probable cause to arrest for driving under the influence. He then walks over to Sergeant Short and shows him the PBT and says, she did really well on her field test, though. And Sergeant Short's response was, she's drunk. She's drunk. I knew it from the minute I saw her. And he goes, yeah, okay. And then he walks back over to her, grabs her, and says, turn around, put your hands behind your back. That is captured on the videotape. And that's why one of the first things I said to the lower court was, thank goodness for videotapes. Because in the report it said that she was argumentative and that she was confused and that she had slurred speech. All of those things did not occur, and that happens every day. When there's not a situation where there's a video that you can confirm that with, that happens every day. And the point that we have in this particular situation is, what else can a citizen do to be able to go on their way in this type of situation? I would submit to the court that there's not erratic driving. There wasn't any weaving in the lanes or crossing over. This is a situation in Rehoboth Beach where one vehicle is tailgating another.
Well, but at the end of the day, we're not talking about whether the evidence is sufficient to convict. What we're talking about is whether the evidence is sufficient to give the police officer reasonable grounds to believe that the chemical test should be given.
That's correct,
Your Honor. A test to which she consents by having a Delaware driver's license and operating a vehicle on the road.
But there still has to...
That's what we're really talking about.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But there still has to be evidence of impairment, and that's the point that I was trying to make.
Well, and what we all know is there is some evidence of impairment. The question is, does it rise to the level to constitute probable cause, given the totality of the circumstances?
Well, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that what we have is evidence that some alcohol was consumed. I would submit to you that there is absolutely no evidence of impairment.
Well, you've only got 50 seconds left of your rebuttal, so maybe you can think about it. But when you come back, if you have time left, describe to me why her driving isn't some evidence of impairment.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, sir.
All right.
May it please the court, Sean Lugg on behalf of the appellee, State of Delaware. Justices, this case is squarely about probable cause, as we all know. In this case, we must begin on Route 1 at the intersection at the red light when Sergeant Short first encounters Ms. LaFay. When Sergeant Short, with his windows up, hears the yelling, sees the, as he describes, bouncing around in the vehicle, and as he describes at that point, the occupants appeared to be visibly intoxicated. We continue with Sergeant Short seeing that vehicle accelerate away from that intersection toward the rear of a gray car, coming so close to that car that, as he describes, the vehicle had no place else to go and ultimately had to accelerate and move to its right in order to evade that vehicle.
What do you mean by the comment, visibly intoxicated?
That was the description that was offered by Sergeant Short as he sat in his unconventional vehicle.
Well, that's very subjective. What are the facts that would allow you to characterize his testimony as visibly intoxicated?
Sergeant Short commented when he testified and drew an analogy to a video, a girl's gone wild was the comment that he used, and that was the first thing that came to his mind with respect to the behavior in the vehicle. And I think it's important to note that because it's one thing to say mumbled speech and certain behavior, but it was so egregious to him that it prompted him, one, to follow that vehicle and pay attention to that vehicle.
Well, he hadn't heard anybody speak at that point, had he?
He explained that after seeing and hearing the noise that he rolled his window down and that the speech emanating from that vehicle was, in his descriptions, mumbled and slurred. But also, it's important
this
to note...
This is as the two cars were driving along the highway.
Correct.
And how many people were in the car?
There were two people in the defendant's vehicle, the defendant as driver and a passenger in that vehicle, Your Honor.
And he was able, from his position, to distinguish who was speaking and whether their speech was mumbled or not?
He was cross-examined on that point, Your Honor, and during cross-examination explained how, from his vantage point, he could see the relative positioning of the two individuals in the vehicle, but also observe the actions and mannerisms of the vehicle. He did not...
Of the vehicle?
Of the occupants of the vehicle. He did not say he could see who was speaking what words at that point in time, to be sure, but he did make observations of them and indicate...
Well, who was then visibly intoxicated, the passenger or the driver?
At this point in time, Your Honor, it was reasonable, articulable suspicion for Sergeant Short. The state is not saying at that point in time that he had probable cause. What the state is saying, though...
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to get to, and I guess you've given me the best answer you can, what facts would lead him to use the phrase visibly intoxicated when he's in a separate car and the motors are running and they're on the roadway? I mean, that talking about mumbled or slurred speech other than boisterous conduct by two young women in a car. I'm trying to make that connection. It's not that easy for me.
Well, I think that's correct. It was boisterous conduct. And he described, there was a description of the passenger apparently hanging out the window, or at least part of her body out of the window. All of those things, though, at that time, it's February 12, 2009, it was testified to, it was not a cold day, but their windows being down, the noise emanating from the vehicle drew his attention to that vehicle. But it's also important to note, too,
well,
with
Mr.
Sergeant Rudd, Short at that point, yes?
Is the state's position that facts that would constitute probable cause were generated between the time Officer Short first saw the defendant's car and the time that it was stopped?
Yes.
There was probable cause at that time?
No, there was not probable cause at that time, but the assessment for probable cause would begin at that
no, I didn't ask event. That. You know, in that interval of time, were sufficient facts generated to constitute probable cause to arrest?
No.
All right. So were any facts that would be, that would be relevant to showing probable cause for intoxication generated during that time?
Yes. During that initial time, his attention was drawn to the vehicle based upon the behavior of the individuals in that vehicle.
Right, which was boisterous, and there was tailgating,
correct.
All of which could have been the product of intoxication, but equally could have been the product of aggressiveness or just plain gross negligence or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
We don't know at that point.
I agree.
Okay, so... Go ahead.
And then that's important to note, but that's what we have there. His attention is drawn to the vehicle. He then continues his observations of the vehicle. He's working a separate function at this point in time. And I believe that is incredibly important in this analysis, that we're looking at what is in his mind and what the observations that he sees prompt him to do. He breaks off from another task. He is in an unconventional vehicle doing another job.
Well, all he can possibly know, isn't it the case, during the time interval that he was observing the car until it was stopped, was that there's behavior that might be consistent with DUI. Might be.
Yes, that is correct.
All right, so it takes something more post-stop to elevate the evidence to the level of probable cause, if any there is.
Yes, yes, it does.
Well, how do you square your answer to Justice Jacobs' question with reliance on his testimony that the occupants of the vehicle were visibly intoxicated? If they were intoxicated, they were impaired, including the driver that he apparently can distinguish from the passenger. He had already concluded, based on what you just told us, that the driver was under the influence. What? How else does one construe the phrase visibly intoxicated?
Well, he made that conclusion after the second thing that happened, and that is...
Oh, he didn't make it when he first observed him with the window stand.
He offered that as testimony, that's correct.
What's that?
He did testify to that. But we need to continue in the assessment as to what happened next, and that is coming upon that gray vehicle. And when he came upon that gray vehicle, or she came upon that gray vehicle, I apologize, she came so close, as the court found, she almost slammed into the rear of the vehicle, prompting that evasive maneuver. Then followed that with a turn with failing to signal into the just-in-time restaurant. Now, at that point, he had a suspicion. He believed they were visibly intoxicated. He testified to that. That belief was confirmed when he strode to the side of that vehicle and, as he testified to, detected a very strong odor of alcohol emanating from Ms. LaFay. At that point, and that is where...
Not from the vehicle, but from her.
From her.
And she's inside and he's outside the vehicle.
She's inside, he's outside. And as he explained...
And he's already explained to us that there's a visibly intoxicated passenger.
That's correct. What he explains...
He's able to distinguish...
He is.
...who is producing the odor of alcohol.
He is, Your Honor. And he went to some lengths in explaining that at this point, as he walked to the vehicle, he lowered himself to the window and was within 2 feet of Ms. LaFay as he detected that odor of alcohol. And on multiple occasions, he explained that it was strong or that it reeked, that she reeked of alcohol. And he, in fact, when he testified, gave somewhat of a Maxwell explanation that each individual factor that he encountered at that point, he conceded might not have been enough for probable cause. But when everything was taken together, the behavior that he observed, both at the stoplight and approaching that gray vehicle, and that odor of alcohol, the strength of the odor, that he concluded that there was probable cause to believe that she was under the influence of alcohol.
Okay, let's stop at that point. Let's assume that at that point there's an arrest and no field testing. Is the totality of the evidence, as we've gone through, it sufficient to constitute probable cause to arrest for DUI?
The state would submit under the Delaware law, yes. That would be probable.
That is, once he detected the odor of alcohol coming from her after the car was stopped, that was enough.
Yes, sir.
And it wouldn't matter whether she passed or failed subsequent field test.
Well, to answer the question, at that point, yes, there's probable cause. I'm not saying, and I would not say that it does not matter what her subsequent performance would be on field test.
Well, if she failed the field test, that certainly would bolster the evidence.
Yes.
It would confirm it. If she failed it, which occurred here, why would it matter if, as you are arguing, there was probable cause once he smelled the odor of alcohol in her breath?
Well, the state does recognize the legal standard we're operating under, and that is that it is a totality of the circumstances analysis.
What are the facts you've just described that he had at his command at that point, and he elected not to arrest her, which he, of course, had the power to do? I assume he brought somebody else to the scene who was equipped for that type of offense, and he wasn't at the time. I assume he didn't have a portable field test, and he didn't have a MOBAT or an intoxilizer or whatever. And he got a road trooper there to carry out what turned out to be the rest of the investigation. But he didn't tell the trooper. here are all the facts I have. In my view, it constitutes probable cause. Lock her up for DUI. That did not happen.
That did not.
Now, if we are laboring under the recognized assumption that totality of the circumstances is the form of analysis for probable cause, under what circumstances can we ignore what followed?
And the state, I don't think there are any. And the state is not asking this court to ignore.
Okay, then you flip the coin of what I asked Mr. Mooney. Tell us why the trial judge, applying the totality of the circumstances analysis, got it right when he concluded that probable cause existed to offer her the chemical test.
Because the court gave weight to each fact that was presented to it. It did not give greater or lesser weight to any particular piece of evidence. And when it calculated or engaged in the assessment of all the facts before it, the court found that there was probable cause. So it's not to say that the field tests are not something that should be considered, whether performance is positive or negative. But what it is to say is that that is simply one of many factors to consider.
What do you agree with Mr. Mooney's characterization that the trial judge got it wrong in part because the trial judge said that there were innocent explanations of why she passed an objective test like a field test?
I don't know if the court necessarily got it wrong. It was a description that the court employed in describing ultimately the conclusions reached. The court did, though, explain its consideration of those factors by virtue of its explanation of excluding other factors, such as the PBT and the horizontal gaze nystagmus. The court clearly balanced.
Help us understand the rule of law you're advocating, because it seems that you're suggesting the field tests can only hurt you. They can never help you. And it goes back to the chronology and kind of parsing the sequence of events. Your position is the police officers could have skipped the field test altogether because they had probable cause to arrest before they ever gave them. Then after they gave the test, nothing changed because the tests have no consequence because they already had probable cause. And what Mr. Mooney is saying is they should have some consequences in this totality of the circumstances equation. So that's my question. First, is it your position they had probable cause and they could have skipped the field test? And if that's your position, which is totally understandable, it has to mean that passing all of the field tests had absolutely no effect on balancing the totality of the circumstances.
I do believe, and it is the state's position, that there was probable cause prior to the administration of the field test. As to the test, and the first comment that Your Honor made was that the tests ultimately have no meaning unless you fail. And that's not what the state is saying.
All right, well, let's put that aside because I don't want to confuse my question with a preamble. But if you do have probable cause and you pass every single field test and nothing changes, you tell me how you describe what happens.
Well, there are a few things. One, and as counsel concedes in their opening brief, the standardized field sobriety tests are not designed to as evidence of non-impairment. The language that was cited is
they don't do the horizontal gaze test, and all of these tests aren't designed to ascertain impairment?
They absolutely are, but they're not designed to ascertain non-impairment. Everything that has been tested is as to, is this person a 0.10 or more, an elevated content beyond what our law requires.
Well, that's tantamount to saying the chemical test isn't designed to produce a result that's inconsistent with impairment. It's only designed to produce a result that's consistent with impairment. That's exactly what Justice Holland just stated, as common sense suggests, that you give the field test in a fair and in a reasonable way to determine either impairment or non-impairment. How can you say that's not designed to determine non-impairment?
Well, I say that because it's correlated based upon specific performance as to some statistics deemed by NHTSA for testing that was done in the 80s. Now,
but isn't the underlying proposition that if you're impaired, you're not going to pass the test?
You may not pass the test. And that was the language I was drawing the court's attention to, that Knudsen completing the test or conducting the test says many people who are under the influence may be able to complete a single test.
So the results are evaluated against some statistical average.
That's correct.
In determining whether or not an individual gets a passing grade. The question that the Chief Justice asked and that Justice Holland asked, is, and I'm going to ask in a different way, is what is troubling us, and that's this. We start with the premise, because it's your position, that there was probable cause before there was any field testing. Correct?
Correct.
All right. Field testing is administered, and defendant passes the field test. The question you're asked is, do we just ignore that? That is, as a legal matter, can the trial judge ignore that? Your response is no, that has to be taken into account. Then we get to the question that you were asked by the Chief Justice, which is, all right, how legally, that is in terms of legal analysis, does the trial judge take into account the fact that despite there being probable cause before any field test was administered, post-field test we now know she passed. How legally does one take that into account?
In the totality of circumstances. And that is where, in looking at those field tests, we can't go back and discount the value of the information that was attained to establish probable cause.
So you discount the value of the field test?
No, you take everything as one, consider it all together, and you determine whether or not it is more probable than not, whether it is probable.
Okay, so you're giving at the you have to give 0.51 probability to the facts that generated probable cause pretest, and no more than 0.49 to the results of the field test.
Well, the state would submit that the standard for probable cause is less than the preponderance to use the numbers that are posed.
All right, pick any set of numbers.
But I think it's important, though, because ultimately the question that is placed before the court is it reasonable, based upon everything that was attained in this case, all the evidence in this case, to conclude that Ms. LaFay may have been, was probably, under the influence of alcohol, and her behavior in that vehicle, the strength of the odor of alcohol, her demeanor, and there was a comment as to the nature of her speech. All are in agreement it was understandable. There was testimony it was slurred. Speech may be slurred yet understandable, may be mumbled yet understandable.
What did the trial judge conclude about that after looking at the videotape?
Concluded that her speech was understandable, Your Honor.
Right. Well, let me try the same question. Imagine you're the trial judge, and you have all of the facts in this case. And the question is, what am I going to say about my evaluation of the field test in the totality of the circumstances? What should the trial judge say about the field test in this case and their significance, their insignificance, or whatever?
They are equally significant to all other facts. And the field test in and of themselves shouldn't be spoken of solely as a field test and a field test. It is, how did this particular person perform, both with respect to the studies and with respect to her performance? And that's important, too, because what the court had was...
I'm losing track of your answer. I asked you to imagine you're the trial judge. I thought you would say something to the effect, I've looked at what the officer had before he started to administer the test, and I think he had probable cause. I've now looked at her successful performance on the field test, and I don't think anything changed. All we have here is a woman who, notwithstanding her obvious impairment, could pass the test. Therefore, under the totality of the circumstances, I think there was probable cause. Isn't that really what your argument is?
It absolutely is, Your Honor. And just to conclude with that point in my remaining seconds, what the court would do in that analysis, too, though, is, how did she perform the test separate from the NHTSA standards? And in this case, the walk and turn, for example, there was one failure but several missteps, and that would be the evidence that the court would have to consider. I thank the court for the opportunity to address. I believe my time is up.
Thank you. 39 seconds, Mr. Manning.
Yes, sir. If I could give a quick hypothetical, if an officer pulls up on the side of the road, sees somebody passed out, knocks on the door, the person's speech is slurred, they're disoriented, they open the car door, and beer cans fall out of the car, the person gets out of the car and says, I'm not doing any field tests, the officer handcuffs them. That's probably probable cause. But if the person gets out of the car, they get it together, their speech is clear, they perform every test spot on, then that's not totality of the circumstances. If you say, well, when he was in the car and he was disoriented and beer cans fell out of the car and ignore the field test, that's not a balancing test. And we would submit to you that that is a balancing test. In that case, there wouldn't be probable cause.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.